Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the historical significance of the Grand Canyon Lodge, which recently burned down in a wildfire, and why budget cuts may lead to scaled back water augmentation projects. But first, there will once again be a candidate named Grijalva on the general election ballot in Arizona's 7th Congressional District. Adelita Grijalva, daughter of the late Congressman Raul Grijalva, won yesterday's Democratic primary in the special election to replace her father and will advance to this fall's general election. She'll face Republican Daniel Gutierrez in September. Grijalva won 62% of the vote. Her next closest competitor was Deja Fox, who won a little more than 20%. Former state lawmaker Daniel Hernandez came in third with about 14% of the vote. And since this is a heavily Democratic district, Grijalva becomes the frontrunner to succeed her dad in Congress later this year. With me now to break down the results is John Washington of Arizona Luminary, who's been covering the race. John, good morning.
Good morning.
So I guess maybe not such a surprise that Adelita Grijalva won this contest, but I'm wondering if the margin by which she won was a surprise to folks in southern Arizona?
Yeah, so we had a really stormy night last night. There was a monsoon that just nailed Tucson, but there was no political lightning. You know, what people probably most expected to happen when the candidates' names were all set shortly after Raul Grijalva died in March is exactly what happened. The presumed frontrunners pulled away easily. And I think that if anyone was concerned in the last few days, looking at potential upset victory from Deja Fox, if you really kind of dug into where she was getting that support, you may have been able to see that a lot of it probably was either online or out of the district. And that seems to have been what happened. And she was able to garner lots of national attention, but she didn't quite get the support that she needed here in southern Arizona.
Yeah, I mean, as you referenced, there have been a lot of national articles written about Deja Fox, yeah, comparing her to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and other younger politicians, asking if she is the future of the Democratic Party. I would imagine, yeah, it's tough to be the future of a party when you lose by 40 points.
Yeah, you know, I think that she certainly ran a savvy campaign, and she knew how to throw out the bait for the national attention, and she definitely got it. There was a Politico article that was published 2 days ago saying that she might pull off an upset victory. But that attention, both online and nationally, just did not translate to votes on the ground. I think, however, Adelita Grijalva addressed Deja Fox's supporters last night after she was declared the winner. And she recognized that Deja had a message that resonated with a lot of people, and she wanted to invite those people into her campaign and use some of that energy. And I think that even she was starting to do that on the campaign. You saw, especially in the last month or so, as Deja started gaining momentum and more popularity, you saw Adelita start putting out more Instagram videos, and they were sort of like slightly higher produced, and they were a little bit, they had some winks and some effects in them. And you know, you see some of those lessons that she seems to be wanting to learn from Fox's campaign.
At the end of the day, how similar or dissimilar were the policy positions and the messages being put out by Grijalva and Fox?
Yeah, that's a good question. There certainly was some daylight between the two of them, but I think both of them were trying to mostly court progressives. As court progressives, the progressive left, without completely alienating the sort more centrist left. And I think that was the strategy that both of them took. There were some nuanced differences in, say, border security, but sometimes they surprised each other. You would think that, oh, well, Deja is the younger one and claiming to be more progressive, that she's the one who's going to more readily say, oh, let's abolish ICE. But it was actually Adelita Grijalva who explained to me that actually ICE as it is right now is something that is an agency that we she would not support. And so she actually went a little bit further there. But then, you know, some of the maybe more progressive taxation things is something that Dajia Fox embraced. So there's, you know, marginal differences between the two of them.
We usually don't talk about third place finishers the day after an election, but I feel compelled to ask, what happened to Daniel Hernandez?
Yeah, so he didn't pull off very many votes in the end. He spent more money, as far as we know, as according to the latest figures, he raised and spent more money than either the other any of the other candidates in the race. And yet, what he was really trying to do, it seemed, was really play it down the middle more. He was in support of mining. He did not go as far left as either Fox or Grijalva in terms of border policy. And there was a sort of a snafu that happened rather late in the campaign. This is something that had to do with American support of the bombardment and genocide in Gaza. And there, Hernandez pushed back, and both of his sisters have been in staunch support of Israel. And he had a sort of not great moment where he actually pushed someone's phone away who was trying to record him on camera. And I think that was maybe one of the straws too far for a lot of people who were maybe leaning towards supporting him.
All right. So, John, very quickly, we should mention there's also a Republican primary yesterday, right, even though it's a heavily Democratic district. Daniel Gutierrez won that race over a few other opponents. Any reason to think that the race in September, the results will be any closer than they were yesterday?
No. And that's something that Gutierrez himself was readily admitting last night. There was an interesting play, though, that he did is he invited to his watch party not only other Republican candidates, but he also invited other Democrat candidates and Green Party. And some of them actually showed up. Patrick Harris, who's running as a Democrat, he came to the party. Gary Swing as a Green also came. And Jimmy Rodriguez, a fellow Republican. They all came to Gutierrez's party. That's a message he wants to send. He's going to be the unifier here. And, you know, I think he still realizes the makeup of the voting district right now really does not skew in his favor at all.
Yeah. All right. John Washington of Arizona Luminaria. John, good to catch up with you. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
Two wildfires continue to burn near the Grand Canyon. The White Sage Fire has burned nearly 53,000 acres and is 4% contained. The Dragon Bravo Fire has burned about 9,300 acres and is 0% contained. That latter fire is responsible for burning down the historic Grand Canyon Lodge on the park's north rim. A bipartisan group of Arizona elected officials has called for an investigation into what happened. The lodge had burned down once before. A kitchen fire in 1932 led to the lodge being rebuilt a few years later. With me now to talk more about this is Davy Crockett, vice president of the Grand Canyon Historical Society. Davy, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Hello. Great to be here.
So what did this lodge mean to you? What does this lodge mean to you?
Well, the north rim is about 1,000 feet or more higher than the south rim. And so it's a very forested area. And that lodge was really a mystical place of peace that so many people would enjoy, including the employees and also the visitors.
How are you feeling now a few days after the lodge met its end?
Very, very sad. I was on the south rim this weekend for a meeting for our society, and I watched as the fire was spreading. I couldn't sleep one night, and the night it actually burned, because I could see the fire just huge across the canyon, and I worried all night.
Did you actually, I suspect you can't actually see it from the south rim, but did you kind of have a gut feeling that something bad was happening?
I did, because I knew the approximate location of it. I've hiked it many times. I hike across or run across the Grand Canyon many, many times, and knew where the lodge was. And it seemed like the flames were higher than they were for normal trees.
For people like you who really love Grand Canyon National Park and are very familiar with the canyon, like, what has been the conversation there over the last couple of days about all this?
Well, the conversation, the main conversation is, will they rebuild? And certainly the national park isn't concentrating on that right now. But, you know, they're trying to get the fire out and make sure things can be protected as much. But in addition to the lodge burning down, about 70 structures, including 3/4 of the little historic cabins that surrounded the lodge, have been burned down.
Would you like to see them rebuild the lodge and maybe the cabins as well?
Certainly I would. As you mentioned, that in 1932, the original one burned down. And they did rebuild this current lodge directly on the same location that the last one was, even using a lot of the same stone that was there for the original one. What's really amazing about this lodge location is it's perched right on the rim, just hugging the rim, yeah. Unlike on the south rim where the lodges are further away.
What would it take, do you think, to rebuild? I mean, is there enough of that same stone, for example, to rebuild it? What do you think it would be possible to sort of recapture the style and the history of it?
I believe so. When they did this second lodge, you know, they were conscious of the fire danger. And so instead of using a lot of wood, they used far, far more stone to do it. And they used stone that was in quarries right there on the north rim. So the hope is, I mean, when they built the second one, though, with the stone, it would fall down. So they had to actually take the stone out and then put it back in. And I think they can do that again.
What does all this mean for the North Rim? I mean, this is obviously a less populated part of Grand Canyon National Park. The place where people stay is no longer there. The government has closed the North Rim for the rest of the season. It, of course, is not generally open during the winter. What does the future of visitation to the North Rim look like in the near term, do you think?
A big impact. The Grand Canyon receives about 5 million visitors per year. And the North Rim, since it's more remote, it gets about 10% of that. So it's a more peaceful place. There's less crowds there. But the lodge was the only place, the lodge and the cabins and the campgrounds, the only place you could stay at the North Rim. So any facilities are much further away, and they're being endangered by the other fire.
So, I mean, I would imagine that this sort of sets that back a little ways. Like, if there's really no place to stay, at least, you know, assuming that it won't get rebuilt before next summer, people probably aren't going to really be able to go there in large numbers anytime soon.
Probably not, because a lot of things were destroyed, including the water treatment plant, the gas station there, visitor center, ranger stations, employee housing, you know, all so many things are gone that it certainly will take a lot of time. Now, the North Rim is a bigger area. There's other places to view the canyon on the North Rim, but you have to get to them through dirt roads.
Right. Interesting. All right. We'll have to leave it there. That is Davy Crockett, Vice President of the Grand Canyon Historical Society. Davy, thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why are some men struggling to maintain romantic relationships? A local dating coach on the line between chivalry and creepiness. But first, air travelers across the U.S. are keeping their shoes on as they move through security. That's after TSA reversed its policy of requiring many people to remove their footwear and run them through scanners with the rest of their carry-ons. The policy of having to take shoes off started in 2006 after a terrorist tried to detonate a bomb hidden in his shoes. With me now to talk more about all this is Brett Snyder, also known as the Cranky Flyer. He runs a blog of that same name. Brett, good morning.
Good morning, Mark.
So I would imagine that this rule maybe, does it make you a little less cranky as a flyer?
Well, I have TSA PreCheck, so I haven't had to take my shoes off for a while anyway. But yes, it's good news.
So what actually precipitated this? Like, what led the federal government to say, no, we don't really need to do this anymore?
Well, it's a good question. You know, the technology has been in place with the millimeter wave technology and the different types of gates that people have to walk through now, as opposed to the old metal detectors that should be able to detect these things on their own anyway. It's been there for a while. So this seems like the government finally getting out of its own way, maybe?
I mean, yeah, I mean, I suspect you're talking about the devices where you walk through and you sort of put your hands above your head, you know, and touch your middle
That's
fingers
right.
together. And, you know, they have the footprints on the ground. It seemed as though those devices were far stronger and maybe more reliable than what we had to do, which raised the question of why we had continued to take our shoes off all this time.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of questions. You know, why can we only have 3 ounces of liquid still and all of that? There are many questions about why is this still here? You'll certainly hear some people refer to this as security theater, makes it feel safer, whether it actually makes things safer or not. Certainly up for debate. But, you know, this was something that was a response to the shoe bomber from more than 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And I'm actually not familiar with any attempts since then to use shoes as a dangerous weapon.
Do you think that this might, as you kind of alluded to with the liquid size and everything, might this be a harbinger of further changes to come in terms of what we are allowed to bring on planes?
Well, that is certainly the hope. I think the liquid rule to me is far more disruptive. You know, taking your shoes off is an annoyance, but you can still bring your shoes with you. The yeah. 3 ounces of liquid is a real challenge for some people. You end up having to check a bag, or you have to find small containers for shampoo or whatever it may be. And so, you know, the technology is there. They're slowly rolling that out for the machines that screen your bags when you go through security. It's not everywhere yet, but it is there to be able to detect any potential threats with liquids as well. So how long that will take to get fully rolled out, I suppose that's up to Congress and how quickly they want to fund the effort.
Right. What have the conversations been in sort of the world of travel, the world of aviation about this policy change? Like, what are people saying about it?
It's funny because normally I think you'll hear some people on one side, some people on the other side. Everyone I've spoken with, it seems to be more just relief. Like, finally, we're doing this. That's what it seems like, because it never really made a ton of sense anyway. You already have all the people with TSA PreCheck that have been doing this and going through with their shoes on. And so, you know, this just felt like one thing that wasn't necessary that they could take away from the process to make it easier for travelers. Of course, you may still have to take your shoes off if secondary screening or anything like that. But
yeah,
for everyone else, this should speed things up and just make it easier.
Has this led to shorter security lines? Are people getting through TSA more quickly? I know this is just a week or so since they announced this, but has it led to shorter lines already?
I actually don't know the answer to that. I would think that it would, in the sense that we've all been in that line where you're waiting and the person in front of you didn't take their shoes off and then they hold up the line and all that happens. But it also will make it easier for everyone. When you get on that other side and people have to put their shoes back on
yeah.
and, you know, find a bench and do all this, it'll just help get people out of the area quicker and make it easier for everyone, regardless of speed, but it should help in every way.
It kind of speaks to the balance, right, between security and, I guess, ease of transport and convenience, right? Like, you want to make sure that you are legitimately screening people going through TSA. You don't want anything dangerous getting on the plane. But at the same time, when people are, like, fumbling, as you say, for their shoes or trying to put their belts back on or get everything and shove it back in their bags, it does hold things up and slow things down a bit.
Yeah, that's right. And it is something that I think has had a real impact on travelers. You know, we've seen, right after 9/11, you know, we're approaching 25 years now since that. It's 24 years this year. There was this reaction of, oh no, our security was completely inadequate. Let's do all the things. And so, you know, individual pieces started being lobbed on top of each other. You had the shoes, you had the liquid rules, you had ever-changing rules. And yeah, it was something that really made it hard for travelers to understand, how early do I need to get to the airport? How do I pack? It was a hugely stressful thing. And we saw short-haul travel actually decline because people found that it was easier to drive for some shorter flights and use alternate ways of doing it. And so anything that can be done here to really weigh the risk of actual security threats with the inconvenience for travelers could have an impact on people's travel habits.
Interesting. All right. That is Brett Snyder, a.k.a. the Cranky Flyer. Brett, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
Three years ago, state lawmakers and then Governor Doug Ducey said they were setting aside $1 billion over 3 years for a water augmentation project. The thinking at that time was that project would be a desalination plant in Mexico's Sea of Cortez. But last year, lawmakers and Governor Katie Hobbs swept more than $300 million from the Water Infrastructure Finance Authority, or WIFA. That's the organization that's responsible for seeking out and funding these kinds of projects. And the organization's director says this year's spending plan isn't much better. Chelsea McGuire says WIFA's board is in the process of reviewing 17 submitted proposals that are looking to be qualified to move on to phase two of a three-phase process. She says by this fall, we should know the basic contours of those water importation proposals, and the teams behind them will be asked to do a feasibility analysis. McGuire joins me to talk about the state of WIFA's finances. And Chelsea, let's start with that recently approved state budget. How did your agency do?
Not well. This is the third year in a row that we have seen significant cuts to WIFA's long-term water augmentation fund in the state budget. The most recent iteration of those cuts totaled about $84 million, which leaves us with about a third of the promised $1 billion that was originally dedicated to that long-term augmentation fund.
And when that money was initially promised, the thinking was that it would lead to, most likely, some kind of water desalination project. The talk was maybe a deal with Mexico in the Sea of Cortez or something like that. Is that project still talked about? Is it still even feasible?
So I'll answer that in two parts and kind of go back to the assumption. I think that was an assumption on the part of a lot of folks. I don't think that was actually the assumption on the part of the policymakers who were designing WIFA and our long-term water augmentation fund.
Okay.
Desalination is, of course, a very obvious solution to augmentation. You're going somewhere, the ocean, to use water that we're not currently using. But that doesn't have to be the solution that is funded by the long-term water augmentation fund, and it's highly likely that it may not be. We don't know yet. We're still agnostic as to what that project looks like. And then to your point, in December of 2022, really just months after the legislation became effective, WIFA was approached with a proposal for a desalination plant in the Sea of Cortez. At that point, WIFA's board, they looked at that and they said, that's really interesting. We're really glad to see that there are proposals out there within the industry. We don't have enough information to make a decision right now. And in fact, we don't know what we don't know. So what we need is not a bunch of proposals just coming in. We need a process for handling those proposals, for attracting those proposals.
Did anybody tell you why WIFA was losing the amount of money it was losing?
I wouldn't say that we've received definitive reasons as to why WIFA is losing that amount of money. What I will say is that the guiding narrative or the most common narrative that we've heard is, well, you don't have a project yet.
So you don't need the money.
So you don't need the money. What are you spending it on? Unfortunately, that's a pretty self-defeating narrative for a couple of reasons. The first is that the money is there to attract the project. If we as a state are a serious partner at the negotiating table with industry, because even $1 billion was not going to be enough, right? Industry is going to have to come alongside and be a partner with WIFA. That money was there symbolic of our commitment to long-term water augmentation. So it was never the amount. It was about the commitment. And so saying, well, we're not going to commit more money to it until you have a project, it's very hard to attract that project and to be a serious partner if the money is not there.
Have you found it so far to be a hindrance in terms of trying to find a new project, not having the money that you need?
I would say yes and no to that. It is a hindrance in that it makes industry kind of look at WIFA and say, well, are you serious about this? And what can you bring to the table? But what I think is important about WIFA, even with the cuts to our budget, even with the uncertainty that we have over sort of the political stability, we still have the ability to go out to industry and say, we're serious about this. We have a mandate, in fact, from our state to do what we are doing. So keep partnering with us. And the process that we have developed, that going back to what our board asked us to do in 2022 and early 2023, has received extremely positive feedback from industry. We just want to make sure that we can underscore and secure that approach with something tangible to bring to the table.
Well, I kind of wonder about that because you mentioned how the money in some ways is symbolic of the state's seriousness in investing with industry and pulling off a project like this. I wonder if in your mind or maybe in the board of WIFA's mind, the fact that the legislature keeps taking back and cutting some of this money, is that in some way maybe symbolic of the way the legislature looks at your mandate and ultimately what you're able to do?
I sincerely hope not. And in private conversations, it's very easy to hear from legislators, to hear from policymakers. Of course, we still believe that augmentation is important. So we absolutely hear we are still serious about this. Unfortunately, actions can speak louder than words. And so we're in a position right now as WIFA, as an entity, of saying we continue to be serious about this. And we will utilize all of the many tools at our disposal to show that we are serious, to prove that Arizona and WIFA is the right partner for industry that's interested in building these kinds of projects, because they are out there and we've proven that. But we continue to be dedicated to that. And I think that's really the message that we want to send.
At this point, if you had to guess, and of course, crystal balls are often cloudy, does it seem as though sort of the one big project is still the way that WIFA is looking? Or maybe given the financial realities under which you're operating, is it maybe a series of smaller projects that are maybe even more regional in nature?
I think it could be both. And when I think of a series of smaller projects, I think of it less in terms of regionality and more of a portfolio. It's really time bound is where I would look at that portfolio. When I think about a portfolio approach, I do think about it in terms of there could be projects that bring water online more quickly, that could be faster, cheaper, potentially easier to bring on online, but are temporary, are not that big volume of water that we need. But those build a bridge, right? And those build a bridge from our current water situation to our future water situation. But there does have to be something big on the other side of that bridge.
It seems like if nothing else, if you had something smaller, that might at least in part alleviate the argument of you guys don't have a project.
That could be true. That could absolutely be true. And as long as, and I think our board has been clear about this, those smaller projects can complement what happens on the other side. Mm-hmm. And they're not draining resources that then make it impossible to do what we need to do on the other side. We're absolutely open to that portfolio kind of approach.
In terms of the money that got cut from your budget this year, in your mind, is it at least going to something that's somewhat close to what your mission is or even just sort of kind of water related?
The short answer is no. There are definitely some water-related tasks or some water-related categories that those cuts were going to. Potentially the most notable is the $1.7 or so million dollars for the Colorado River Litigation Fund through the Department of Water Resources. But honestly, much of those cuts feel a little bit like we couldn't find money in the budget anywhere else, and so we're taking it from WIFA. Things like fire suppression. Not a bad thing, obviously. Definitely something that we need to prioritize as a state. The problem is prioritizing other things at the expense of our long-term water augmentation future and our ability to attract and to finance and to make affordable whatever that project is at the end of the day.
Well, so given all of that, do you see the ship has sort of sailed on the state having that investment money, that we're serious money in, you know, in WIFA's hands to attract the kind of private enterprise and industry and, you know, other entities that you're going to need? Or, you know, maybe next year they put some amount of money back in WIFA's budget and it's just fine.
Yeah. I don't think the ship has sailed. And I think that because of the conversations that we've had consistently with policy leaders across the state who say, no, we do understand and we do recognize the importance of augmentation. This is just kind of the thing we had to do. That's unfortunate, and I wish the narrative were different, but I don't think the ship has sailed. I think that there are still leaders in the water policy world. I think there are still leaders across the state who will be willing to go to bat for WIFA and to say this is important and this work that we're doing is good. They're doing it in the right way, and we want to continue to support that.
All right. That is Chelsea McGuire, director of the Water Infrastructure Finance Authority, or WIFA. Chelsea, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Last year, Phoenix's scorching hot summer stretched into the fall. We went nearly 4 months straight without seeing high temperatures even dip into the double digits. So this summer, we're taking a deeper look at something that can help us mitigate that torturous heat: shade. From planting trees to building structures, we're asking how we can live more comfortably in these intense conditions, and we are calling this series Throwing Shade. Today, let's turn to our largest organ, our skin. From sunscreen to hats to a multi-million-dollar skincare industry to, yes, shade, we go to extreme lengths to keep our skin safe from the sun. But it hasn't always been that way. Nita Jablonski is an anthropologist and paleobiologist known for her research into the evolution of skin color in humans. My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with her more about the history of skin and the sun.
Begin for us with some of that ancient history, for lack of a better phrase, right? Like, what did the skin of our ancient ancestors likely look like? Like, we can study skeleton bones, fossils, things like that, but, you know, we don't have, like, prehistoric skin that you can study, right? What do we think it looked like?
Exactly. Well, a lot depends on where we start. But if we think about the common ancestor of chimpanzees and humans who lived about 7 or 8 million years ago, they would have looked probably quite chimpanzee-like in their skin. But that situation changed a lot beginning around 2 million or 1.5 million years ago, when we see really modern-looking people emerging in Africa. Around 1.5 million years ago, what we see is a few really important things. Loss of most of the body hair that had covered our bodies, and the evolution of dark permanent pigmentation in our skin that protects us from ultraviolet radiation. Huh. So this was like super important for protecting us from bright sun, which was part of our environment.
Right. Like, people were living in the outdoors all the time, and human skin used to stand up to it, it sounds like, in a very different way than it does now. Like, these ancient folks were not getting sunburns.
I think what we have to recognize is that our ancestors basically lived out of doors. They certainly took shelter when they could, under trees and under rock shelters and so forth, but they were exposed to the elements. And so the skin was their primary interface between their interior bodies and the outside world. So the skin did evolve to be incredibly versatile and protective. We think of our skin as being relatively delicate, but actually it's super tough.
That's a really interesting way to look at it. Yeah. And we think of it as delicate because we do so much to protect it, right? Like, we wear sunscreen, we wear hats, we are very conscious today of skin cancer and protecting our skin and staying out of the sun. We have, you know, protective clothing and shelter and shade and all of these things. But that wasn't always the case. Tell us a little bit about how that started to change. When did our skin start to adapt because of the way our societies adapted?
Well, actually, it's relatively recently in evolutionary terms. When you think about our species, Homo sapiens, we've been around for over 300,000 years. Our skin really was taking the brunt of the environmental burden until around 25,000 years ago, when we see good evidence for sewn clothing in the archaeological record and evidence for the, you know, dwellings. And we especially started covering up and doing these things when we were moving into extreme environments, especially extremely wet and extremely cold environments. When some of our ancestors were moving out of equatorial latitudes far into northern Eurasia, for instance, that's when we really get to see a lot of changes in the skin that are related to changes in our position on the Earth's surface.
Right. So this is when I think your research gets really interesting, right? Because you're essentially talking about the development of race and like the different ways in which different skin in different places pigments. Talk a little bit about how that turned into kind of a way of stratifying societies.
It turns out to be a story not so much about race, but about where you live. Mm-hmm. Because people who were dispersing into northern latitudes, into Eastern Asia and Western Europe, actually underwent independent loss of their dark pigmentation. So it doesn't really put them into the same race or different races. It just makes them very different because they have achieved the same appearance or roughly the same appearance, but through entirely independent genetic means. Hmm. So this is really cool because it means that the natural selection pressures in evolution were sufficiently great that these changes had to occur for these people to continue to live successfully in these habitats. And what it means is that this putting of people into groups according to their superficial appearance doesn't work at all because we have a lot of lightly colored people around the world who don't fit into any of the same races. And similarly, we have a lot of darkly pigmented and highly tannable people who don't fit into the same race. So it's a great evolutionary story, but it's a tragic story with respect to human classification and what we've done with this information on skin color.
Yeah, yeah. So let me ask you a kind of forward-looking question to end with, Nina. I mean, as we're watching our environment change right now, right? Like we're watching climate change happen. We're watching, especially here in the South, Southwest, summers become longer, extreme temperatures, extreme exposure to sun really becoming more of the norm. Having studied the way that the sun has kind of interacted with our skin over the last, you know, many millennia, what are your predictions for how this might change in the future?
We will continue to mostly shelter ourselves from the sun. So in Arizona and other very sunny places, people spend a lot of time indoors. And people who normally spend time indoors, like the vast majority of people do in the summertime, get very good at protecting themselves when they go out of doors because the penalty for not doing that is so great. And the extremes of long summer heat are only going to continue to be more felt over the coming decades.
Yeah. Okay. That is Nina Jablonski, professor of anthropology emerita at Penn State University, joining us to talk about our skin and the sun and long history there. Nina, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
You're most welcome, Lauren. It's been a pleasure.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. The ideological gap between straight men and women seems to be widening. The debate over gender roles seems to be expanding and contracting at the same time. And amidst all the stories about the identity crisis among American men, many of them are turning to dating coaches like Blaine Anderson. Anderson, who posts online under the handle Dating by Blaine, says she learned a lot about dating from her days in a U of A sorority. On her Instagram page, where she has more than 700,000 followers, she doles out free advice.
Fellas, here is a message that gets a 99% response rate. Underrated sexy habits that you should adopt as a man.
Three texts to never send a girl.
Here are the things girls say they want, versus what they actually mean.
Three alpha traits that make you irresistible to women.
Here is the secret to attracting beautiful women. It's treating her like a normal person.
Anderson also works with paid clients. She offers self-led courses, group coaching, one-on-one programs on how to text women and online dating, and a masterclass on dating in person. My co-host Sam Dingman wanted to know what the most common needs of the men she works with are and why they seek her out in the first place.
Sometimes they don't know exactly what they aren't doing right when they come to me. But what I learned that they aren't doing well is oftentimes not creating chemistry and not positioning themselves as a romantic partner.
So if I'm hearing you right, they're going in with an energy that is maybe designed to try to not be threatening, to not make the woman feel like they are expecting some kind of romantic element to the relationship. And that is somehow not sending the signal they want to send.
Correct. That's a good description.
When you say something like that to one of these men who comes to you, how do they respond? Like, what do they tell you are the reasons that they're not doing those things?
The number one reason is the fear of being creepy, the fear of making a woman feel uncomfortable, or just thinking that, oh, if I do that, then she might, you know, get the wrong idea and I don't want to come off as a creep or a pervert or something.
These guys that come to you and they have whatever assumptions they have about what women do or do not want, how much do you talk to them about where they're getting those signals from, and what do you make of the sources?
If you ask them, you know, where did they come from, they probably can't point to any one source. It's sort of things that they've collected maybe from guy friends along the way, what they've seen in movies, some of their own personal experiences, which is a very small sample size. And that is dictating, you know, how they act today.
Would you say that most of the men that you work with are looking to get married?
Oftentimes, yes, they eventually want to get married. Some clients might want that sooner rather than later, whereas some are just looking to right now have more options dating because one day they want to get married and they want to make sure they have good options when the time comes for them to settle down.
One of the reasons I'm curious about that is because we've had a number of conversations here on our show about this moment that is happening, at least in the conservative political arena. There's just been a tremendous amount of talk about a return to some kind of masculine value that certain pockets of the conservative world feel like has gone away and needs to be resurrected. And then simultaneous with that, there has been this big movement online of the so-called trad wife and women who are interested in a return to a kind of 1950s set of values around femininity and marriage and what that looks like. And in my own experience reporting on this, I have spoken to a lot of young men who are really, really adrift because of all of that and feel like, you know, if a woman, for example, so much as does not allow him to hold the door for her, you know, I've spoken to a number of young men, actually, who, when it comes to that interaction specifically, if that happens, they feel like they don't even know how to be a man anymore. And I don't say that to make fun of them. I their confusion in that moment seems really genuine to me. Is that a dynamic that you find in the interactions that you're having with your clients, any of this conversation about returning to what some people feel like is traditional masculinity or traditional femininity?
That's very interesting. I haven't heard that one in specific. I see a lot of confusion from the men I work with around expectations and what should they be doing, what shouldn't they be doing. My principles tend to fall someplace in the middle, skewed towards more traditional male-female dynamics, because I think the vast majority of women do actually want a guy who will hold the door for them and who is going to pay for the first date. Does that mean that they expect that they also want to be a stay-at-home, you know, trad wife and cook dinner for their husband every night? I don't know. Like, some yes and many, many, many no.
Right.
But they're getting too in their head about the right and the wrong.
Well, that is a big thing that I feel like is coming across to me in this conversation that we're having, Blaine. I have to say, is that it seems like there is, and I'm sure this has always been true, but there is this narrative out there in a lot of these men's heads about how they're supposed to be. And that it seems like what you're saying is that those narratives are really unhelpful.
Yeah. You know, it depends, because on one hand, these narratives are oftentimes unhelpful. But on the other hand, there are best practices that you can follow that are going to get you the best results most of the time.
I was looking at your Instagram, where you give away free tips sometimes on things like, you know, how to text a woman after you've had a date with her or something like that. And some of the comments that are left by what I presume are men would seem to fly in the face of a lot of what you've been telling me about. There was somebody who wrote a comment on one of your posts saying, if she's easy to talk to, then she's not worth it. Somebody else wrote something like, fellow men, never take advice about women from women. Fishermen, do not ask a fish how to catch fish. Obviously, you know, I'm sure you're not spending a lot of your time responding to these comments, but how much do comments like that inform the conversations you end up having with people who are working with you, which I'm assuming these commenters are not?
Yeah, I would say zero. the type of person who leaves a comment, you know, on my Instagram or on one of my videos saying my advice is trash or this will never work because I'm a woman isn't the type of person I work with or I want to work with.
Right. Well, that makes sense. But in the vein of what you were saying about somebody challenging you, I guess, and saying, like, why should I take advice from you and not another man? Mm-hmm. I am curious, what do you make of the advice that men give other men, generally speaking?
Yeah. So usually when if a guy is like, well, I don't know, you know, I heard this from my guy friend. My response is, well, has that been working for you? And the answer is usually, well, no. And it's like, okay, well, let's try it my way then.
Right. Friendly reminder that you have hired me.
Yeah.
Well, I guess as a last question then, Blaine, I mean, I think the implication of my question earlier about this dynamic around masculinity that we're seeing in a lot of online conversations when it comes to male influencers on social media or podcasts, that sort of thing. The implication there is that there is some sort of crisis going on amongst men, some sort of identity crisis. And I guess I'm just curious how much you see that bearing out in the work that you do. Do you think things really have changed?
You know, yes and no. I certainly see it playing out online and I think in the landscape of dating and men generally. The men who come to work with me are generally really well-rounded and awesome guys who I don't see necessarily falling victim to the loneliness epidemic, for example. Mm-hmm. They aren't the ones who are necessarily falling behind in other areas of their life. It is more that dating has changed so much, so rapidly, that they need help catching up.
Well, Blaine Anderson is a dating coach and a matchmaker and runs her own company at datingbyblaine.com. Blaine, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
And that'll do it for this Wednesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being along. Remember, you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It's called Radioheads. Sign up at theshow.kjzz.org. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.